and welcome to Teach Me Teacher, a podcast for educators where we, the teachers, become students ourselves. I'm your host, Jacob Chastain, and today we are returning with Matthew Kay for part two about his book, Not Light, But Fire. It is absolutely amazing. If you've not listened to part one, go back right now, go listen to part one. It's a great part of the interview. In part two, we get super deep into some of his concepts about his book, some of the philosophical principles of everything, and really just have a great conversations about the struggles and the successes of having these types of conversations and why we should be having these conversations specifically in our classrooms, specifically for us American teachers who are in the political climate that we are currently in. Ladies and gentlemen, this episode is again sponsored by Stenhouse Publishers. Do me a solid, go buy this book, support them. They are publishing amazing stuff.
Good morning, class!
So cool to be yourself in life and in your class.
Kids just want to be loved and they want to be noticed for who they are.
Students respond a lot better to kind, positive remarks.
I really want my students to know is that I care.
Without a strong culture, nothing else was going to get done.
Teach Me Teacher is, I just want to call it a revolution. One of my favorite quotes, and I can't quote it exactly, but one of my favorite interviews with Obama was after he had left office already. And, you know, he was kind of reflecting on, you know, his role in the political spectrum and kind of the aftermath and everything like that. And he goes, you know, he talks about, you know, how they accomplished a lot, but a lot of the things that he wanted to accomplish and a lot of the conversations that he was hoping would happen didn't happen. And race was one of those things that occurred. He was like, you know, this we became, you know, division, you know, whether it got more divided or the lines just got more clear, really echoed because of that administration and what that meant. But it was this idea of, you know, okay, so I have friends from all kinds of political spectrums and backgrounds, but, you know, it's my non-educational friends who tend to talk about, they're like, they don't understand why race is still a conversation in a lot of ways. Like they're, it's almost like they're fed up with the conversation. And I've tried to tell them, I'm like, if you were in, like when I'm in my classroom, you know, race is just, it's integral to what's happening because of the issues. Like when I have kids coming into my class crying when a certain person gets elected because they're afraid that they're about to get deported tomorrow, that's a conversation, that's a race conversation.
It's a race conversation.
That's a huge race conversation. And it was at my campus, it was like, I mean, it was all of these kids were in mourning. Like we didn't get anything done, and none of us teachers, we weren't prepared for that because we kind of were prepared, but it wasn't. I mean, it was like the volume of the effect of one person's election had on 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. Like we were like, oh my! And you know, we have people on the campus who voted all different ways, right?
So sure.
It was this volume, and I'm like, when I talk to people who are like, can't we just move on from this race issue? I'm like, no, we can't, because it's still so deep in America's society. But I feel, and I'm getting to the question of, do you see that as like, you know, I tend to feel like educators are kind of more in the know because they deal directly with it, but it's people on the outside, they're like, it's like, why are we still having these conversations? It's like it's almost like there's a disconnect between what reality is and what people are willing to talk about. Like, do you see where I'm kind of going with that?
Well, I'll bring it right back to the classroom. Is what I'm trying to do as a teacher is, you know, kid by kid, class by class, year by year, pump into the world adults who are at least academically, spiritually, emotionally, socially aware enough to realize that race is still a worthwhile conversation. And in fact, is one of our more important conversations. You know, I'm not trying to pump out folks who agree with me. Although on certain things, I have no problem saying I'm right and certain ideas are wrong. I have no problem. Ask my kids and we get into it and we have a good time. I want to be honest. I don't think that people who think that race is not a worthwhile conversation are living a aware, scholarly life. There's no way. It's impossible. The stats are everywhere. The world is everywhere. Where do all the brown people live? Where do all the white people live? What do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You could run down. I didn't write that book. That book's been written a billion times. You can see how race has impacted this world. It's there in plain sight. You don't have to look very hard for it. So anyone who doesn't see that is not using their brain. They're not thinking. And, you know, as a teacher, at the very least, we want thinking people, right? Like, we don't want people with their head in the sand. And, you know, that's why we're doing it. And if we're not doing that, what are we doing in the classroom? You know, we want people to have opinions about things that are real. And race is real. And anyone who says it's not real is not paying attention. And I'm sure you can be a good person and not be paying attention, but you're not a scholar. And I want scholars. I want people who like ideas.
Yeah.
And you cannot like ideas and also think race is not a worthwhile conversation. It's impossible.
Yeah, I just, you know, one more point on this and then I'll get to the next thing. But it was just, you know, I can't help but think, like, when we have people ranting about football players kneeling and we think that race isn't a part of that and is deeply connected to that and it's not just about, quote, disrespecting the flag or our soldiers or something like that. If we can't be honest that there's a deeper issue happening with this type of protest, then I feel like we're, you know, there's just massive ignoring happening. It's,
well, you hit the word honest, right? It's dishonest. And, you know, I'm trying to honor the spirit of Frederick Douglass with the not light but fire, because he was so annoyed with a dishonest conversation. He said, we sitting here at the 4th of July and you brought a whole escaped slave up here to speak to y'all about freedom. This is dishonest. This is ridiculous. And that whole speech is just hammering them about how ridiculous this entire concept is, this entire moment. It's a fake moment. It's fraudulent. And he's saying, as a country, we're fraudulent in our conversation with race. Left, right, and center, we're just fraudulent. And the fact that we're even having a conversation about whether it is about race that someone is kneeling, when he says it's about race, it just shows our fraudulent spirit in this country when it comes to race conversations. We will do anything but do it for real. We'll find 1,000 ways to avoid a legit conversation, left, right, and center, like everybody. We just won't talk about it. We'll find people who agree with us, and then we will bury ourselves deep, and then we'll pretend real well. And we're very good at pretending, but we won't have exchanges, and we won't be honest, and we won't deal in race the way that the topic deserves.
So what does it take? What does it take to get us past this basic level of discussing this?
A bunch of teachers, you know, from my sphere of influence, right? Again, like I said at the beginning, like, it's not just teachers, but that's just what I know. That's what I'm writing about. And I don't want to get too far into, you know, stuff that's not my expertise and not my life experience. There are people who have studied this a lot more than I have. Sure. And so, but as far as conversations, teacher's sphere of influence is normalizing race conversations and making it a part of the curriculum. I say in chapter 3, that's the part I was most nervous about in chapter 3, because I was nervous that folks might read chapter 3 and feel as if I wanted folks to sidestep race when I spoke about, you know, talking race all year. It may sound to those who aren't fully engaged in the text and what I'm trying to say that I'm trying to be evasive. But what I'm saying is race should be a topic that should not just be taught in February. Like, you should be talking about brown people all year. Brown people should be in every book you read, and brown people should be in every, every piece of history you read. What about the brown people who are nearby, or the brown people who are doing it, the brown people who did ideas, both about their interactions with white people and just brown people without white people? Like, it should be everywhere. It should be normalized. And sometimes you could talk about race and not talk about racism. Like, you can talk about race and leave white people out of it, and it's okay. But what happens now is we just talk about race, you know, only in its interactions with white people and with oppression, which leads everyone annoyed with the subject because it's just the same thing. It's either victimhood or accuse or accusation. And we just robbed the subject of its complexity. So that's what teachers can do. I mean, some things are not easy, but they're very simple. It is very simple. Talk about brown people a lot. Center their stories every now and again. Ask yourself, where are the brown people in this topic? Bring it up. Talk about it. Engage it, just like you engage white people. And from there, many complexities emerge that require our best, you know, teach yourselves. But at the very least, what we can do is center conversations about race.
You know, a lot of my influences, you know, I have, you know, Penny Kittle, Donalyn Miller, all these guys. They are, you know, they talk often about, you know, Donalyn Miller has a book coming out soon about book access. But you know, this idea that we have a canon in literature that is predominantly white in a lot of areas. And as an English teacher, you know, when I first really started looking at it, I was like, oh, you know, I was like, wow, we're really reading a lot of this stuff. And I looked at my students and I was like, that's not right. And then, you know, that's when I started bringing in, you know, all of these books about all of these different backgrounds and different authors and started really diversifying, because it's really easy from just to do what you've always done, right? It's really, and it's easy. You know, this is the canon we read. These are the authors we read. These are the authors we highlighted. And, you know, we do our obligatory, you know, Martin Luther King, and we do those things, but we don't hit on like this background. And then I went to, you know, the Ron Clark Academy, and they do amazing stuff to where they teach tons of U.S. history, but they do massive units on these influential, you know, brown people, as you say, who were a part of the history that we just forget about, or we conveniently just, oh yeah, they were great too, or we only talk about the big ones. Yeah. And or, you know, looking at, you know, the history of these amazing people from other countries that we just ignore in our history books and whatnot. And I always thought those pieces were powerful of, you know, highlight, you know, white history is just a tiny piece of why this country is the way it is. But you would think it's the entire piece if you look at the history books and our literature canon.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, no doubt. And I think both in literature and history, as much as you can to decenter whiteness, you know, and whiteness will survive. Whiteness is centered everywhere.
Yeah, let's make that clear for
like,
people.
Whiteness
listening.
Will be okay. Like, yeah. And dead whiteness will be very okay because they're dead and it's okay. It's they're fine. It's funny because I teach, and I've taught for 12 years the Odyssey, and I love the Odyssey. I teach me some good Odyssey. It's fantastic. And then this year I'm reading What Is the What instead with the students, just because I was tired of the Odyssey. And I was in the space, and I'm space now where I got this refugee journey that I'm reading about, and I'm like, this journey is objectively better than Odysseus's journey. It's like objectively better. I love the Odyssey, I was inspired. I was going to write one, and I was going to read a different version of it this year. I just didn't have the money to pay for it. And then I lucked into this other text and had a similar experience. I went to the ILA to present on Not Light But Fire, and I'm surrounded by all these.
Were you at ILA this summer?
Yeah.
Man, I was one of the teachers. You. I was up there.
Yeah. And so I'm surrounded by all these folks who have read all of these things. I went back to my colleagues and I'm like, I think I'm a pretty well-read dude. And I came back from ILA. I'm like, I know nothing. Like, I'm just surrounded by all these people. And I'm having the same experience. I'm like, I could be teaching this. I could be teaching this. I could be teaching this.
And I say that as someone whose 10th graders are reading Lord of the Flies now. Like, I like good stories, and I find good things in good stories. And we should do our best to not just have obligatory brown people in the things we discuss, but, you know, bring them in a meaningful way to all of our conversations about the things that we're learning. Not as a favor, but as their right.
Yeah.
Like the, you know, like you said, you know, just as much building the country as white people did.
You know, there was we did a podcast. One of my first podcasts we ever did for Teach Me Teacher was with Miss Marguerite. I don't know if she still listens to the podcast, but she was this teacher who, she did this amazing like door decoration, right? I saw it popped up like on my Facebook feed, but it was amazing. And I knew she had something to say because it was like, you know, it was a black woman. She had this big, beautiful hair, and it was like this whole, I mean, it was like this whole thing. It was a spectacle. I'm like, this girl, she's got something to say, right? She's doing it very artistically right now. So I reached out to her. Sure enough, she had a lot to say about, you know, race and highlighting all of these people that in history and in our culture and literature that just don't get highlighted, right? And not the obligatory names that everyone does, but these deep roots that are just a part of our culture as anything else. And, you know, it was one of the things that she mentioned as she was talking. She started dropping all these names that I consider myself a well-read person. I try to be really diverse. She was naming so many things that I had I just didn't know. I just started taking notes because I was like, I'm someone who's tried, but there's still so much for me to learn about these pieces of culture that weren't taught to me in high school. They weren't taught to me in middle school. They weren't taught to me in college. And mm-hmm. they are just as valid, if not more valid right now because of the state of our country that we need to learn from. And it's just, I can, you know, it's almost like I can see how we're stuck in these ruts because, you know, we don't know what we don't know. And unless we're reaching out to talk to people who know different things than us, I don't think we're going to grow in the ways that we need to.
Yeah, and that's why I was telling folks – that's why my response to your question about, like, folks who are nervous and scared and stuff like that, and my response was, after acknowledging that the fear is real, was to get over yourself. It's because we're surrounded by people who can educate us.
Yeah.
Like, I work with some colleagues that push me every day. And their colleagues, and I'm especially since the book has been out, people have been touching base. There are so many people in the world who are smarter than us, who are more exposed to things than us, and who can help us build the thing so we're a little less nervous next time and we can really help our kids. So we have to get over ourselves. Like, you don't get the right to be nervous. Being nervous to engage race is a privilege.
So I really want to hit on, you know, kind of in these closing minutes is – you know, you bring up setting up this ecosystem to allow for hard conversations, and, you know, you talk about, like, the dialogic, you know, like, tradition of what you do. And how, for people who have listened this far and haven't turned it off in rage or, you know, or are really looking to be a part of a solution or be a part of something that helps heal some of the wounds that are still persistent – what's your advice on setting up a quality ecosystem for these things? And what do you mean by that in the first place?
Well, I mean, I have very specific advice that you would have to get the book to
hint,
to fully,
hint, buy the book, buy the book.
Yes. I mean, like I try to be as granular as possible with some examples and again, not claiming a panacea, like, you know, I try to give you, you know, what works for me in good detail, and while also welcoming you to create activities that are like that, that work just as well, because, you know, that's what I did. Like, I took good news and high grade compliments. I shout Zach Chase's name all the time whenever these things come up, because I did not come up with them. And I just looked at his at one of his interviews, and apparently he got one of them from someone else. And it's just, ideas are spreading and they're moving, and I take it and I make
you know, I make some adjustments so it works with my teaching style and with my personal pedagogy, and I welcome someone else to, you know, pick and choose strategies. But I think comprehensively, a lot of the suggestions that I make work as a framework. Now you can pick things out and make adjustments. But I try my hardest with the first four chapters of the book, like over half of the book. I try to dedicate over half of the book to how you set up your world, both curriculum wise, student relationship wise, all the things you need to do so that you can have strong, meaningful race conversations. And I think one of my biggest nightmares, and I know there's nothing I can do about it, but one of my biggest nightmares is someone looking in the table of contents and seeing N-word, boom, always wanted to do that. I'm going to be a super teacher. And they jump in and they just read from there, and they read the last four chapters of the conversations, and they say, ha ha, I know how to do this. That's my worst nightmare, because all of those chapters depend on the building of relationships, the training of interpersonal skills, the examining of your curriculum, your questioning strategies, how you group kids, how you ask them to speak to each other. All of those things, all of that is dependent on you understanding those things. If you should not be launching into race conversations if you're not doing those things. I feel very comfortable saying that. I'd rather you not talk about race then launch into race without being mindful about the ecosystem that you've set up in your classroom. It's not worth it. Like, and I say that often, and sometimes there's gasps, but there's never anyone who strongly disagrees after thinking about it a little bit. Like, if you've not set up the ecosystem where students are going to listen to each other, why are you having, why are you discussing things where the kids have the capacity to hurt each other? It doesn't make sense. Like, if they're not trained listeners, if they're not practiced listeners, if your curriculum is not responsive to their listening, why on earth are you asking them to speak about the gentrification that moved them out of their house? You're out of line. Like, you are asking them to engage things that they that you have not set up the environment to be safe for. And so, without getting into too many specifics, I just have to hammer home the idea that you don't rush conversations. You build environments, you build relationships, you build community so that these conversations can work, and that your mistakes can be dealt with and they aren't magnified. It's important. And, you know, similar, it's like everyone wants to play the game, but you have to want to get in the gym if you want to be good. And the first four chapters are the gym. Like, you have to be able to get good at your interpersonal skills.
Yeah.
And that's hard work.
What do you, when, you know, what this phrase, and I've never heard this phrase before, so you can correct me, but, you know, the first time I heard it is in your book, but the preacher's dilemma, right? Is that, did you come up with that phrase, or is that from somewhere?
So I think I came up with it, but.
You about to get an email.
I know. I don't feel comfortable saying I didn't intentionally take it. I didn't intentionally. If someone else has said it, I think it's a concept that I cannot have been the first person to make that analogy. So I feel comfortable saying that someone else has said it before, but I wasn't citing them. I have not heard it before. But I like the idea because, you know, a preacher. You know, and I go to church. I grew up in a church. I teach Sunday school. I come from preachers, and so I'm very familiar with that culture. And a preacher's big, it seems to be their big challenge is they have something that they believe is very important to the people they're talking. Like, this conversation is very, very, very important. But the text that they're working with by, you know, is archaic, you know, it's old, and the parishioners, the congregation, the people in the audience who he wants to have the conversation with might not see the value in this text. And the preacher, by nature of, you know, who they are. I think it's literally the most important thing ever. and so there's a disconnect. And I feel like that analogy works for sometimes how we speak about race. Sometimes we think we know for certain that the thing we're discussing is important and it's life-changing. And if only these kids would get it. And the kids have trouble recognizing that. Like they, you know, we say, don't you know that if you figure out this thing about literacy, then you'll have completely different life outcomes. You'll get to do this thing. Don't you know that you cannot face your dreams? You cannot achieve your dreams unless you take this thing I'm giving you. And the kids go, yeah, when's lunch? Like they're not, you know, them seeing the importance of the thing is really hard.
Yeah.
And so I just like that. I just like that analogy where, you know, and just like a preacher, a teacher says, man, this stuff's important. It's really important. And so how do I make that thing seem, how do I get some importance across?
I think that's, you know, as kind of a closing thought on this is, I think that's almost half the battle of this podcast, you know, episode and episode similar to it. You know, anytime I bring up race or something that's politically charged or, you know, whatever, I know talking to people in 67 countries are listening to this. I get emails all the time from people who connect to what we're doing, you know, in the Middle East or in all kinds of places that I would have never even imagined were listening to my voice talk about education, right? And it's like, but these conversations that I feel are super important, you know, it's like, I hope this episode does a good job. You know, I hope your book does a good job at getting people to take this seriously and really think about, you know, the value of this and why it's important, right? The same way we look at our students and go, I need you to I really want you to understand why this is important, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, I hope that people, you know, the fact that we're spending an hour of our Friday talking about this, you know, I really hope that that comes across. But, you know, before I let you go, I want, what's like a tip that you can give or like a closing of your idea that would really help someone, you know, in a final moment to get them to maybe take the next steps in having these conversations in their classrooms?
I am especially proud of chapter one, where I'm speaking about, that's why I said buy my book. I really took special care in having folks reflect on what safe space means and how to build one that is authentic in their classrooms. I say often that we just say the term safe space like it's magic. We say, this is a safe space. I want you to feel safe. As if the students are then, just because we said it, going to feel safe. Just because we're good people and because we said the magic words. But in fact, ask any young person that you encounter, and you'll discover a massive disconnect between how safe a teacher thinks the classroom is and how safe it actually feels to them, to the students. And the first chapter I really try to force my colleagues all over the country to do the same reflection I had to do. You know, I'm less young, but, I'm still youngish and halfway charismatic and halfway funny and all of these things. And sometimes it's easy for me to think that because a student is laughing, or it's because students give me high fives, or because of those things, they feel safe. And time again, I've been humbled in that. Students have said, I like him. He's funny. I think he cares about me, but I don't feel safe in that room. And I've had to sit with that. And it's like, I thought that exchange went well. I don't think it went well, Mr. K. There are so many things you did not hear. Like when you were paying so much attention to this part of the classroom over here, you didn't hear what so-and-so said to me. You didn't hear what so-and-so did. You don't know what was said after we left your classroom in the hallway. You don't know what was said online. You don't know, and you, that thing, that time when you made me speak what I didn't want to, here's why I didn't want to. Or that time, et cetera, all the faux pas that I try to mention in the book, I only mention it because I did it. I only mention it because I tried it, and students have told me that that makes them feel unsafe, or that does not work in helping them to better engage the topic or build relationships with their classmates or understand the world better. And they're telling me because they think I thought it worked. And so they're telling me, Mr. K, I love you. I'm looking out for you. What you're doing doesn't work. And I think that safe space thing that we say, you know, teachers of goodwill, some people don't care about safe spaces, and that book's not for them. But for people who care, I really want us to be thinking very, very carefully about that and using the parts of our brains that are trial and error, the parts of our brains that are the same. I'll say it this way, the same intellectual energy and professional energy that we use crafting thoughtful curriculum should be spent building relationships. If we were halfway as thoughtful about building the relationships in our classrooms, both between students and us and among the students, as we are in planning curriculum, we could do so much more as far as conversations are concerned. If those relationships were rich and meaningful, then the conversation can be richer and more meaningful. And so it's not simple. Unlike some other things that we talked about, it's not simple. It's hard work. That's the hard work. And if you do that, you'll already – the feedback I'm hearing from people is that even that chapter alone, after reading that and after doing the thought work and making their own adjustments to fit their style, that alone has made them feel better to not just tackle race in, but to tackle issues of gender and sexuality and issues of religion and issues of all the tight, the tough stuff we have to deal with and talk about as teachers to make the world better for our students. They feel better because the relationships are stronger. So I'd focus there. Now, I wrote about race, but that's not the only tough conversation out there. And I think chapter one is meaningful to everyone outside of the specific race conversations that I talk about.
Like I said earlier, like the bit in the podcast, those early chapters that just like blew me away, and then I just piled through the book. So I second your if anything, read the first, but you're going to buy the book anyway, listeners, because you love supporting the people we have on Teacher Teacher. Matthew K., if people wanted to talk to you, find you, follow your stuff, where would they go?
At Matt R.K. on Twitter and Instagram. You can hit me up through, well, I think that's, yeah, and Twitter and Instagram. I'm Matt R.K. I was thinking that through a little bit. I'm able, the good thing is we're in the early stages of things, so I still can engage folks in some pretty direct dialogue, which is cool. I love doing that. I love that folks who are reading the book have been reaching out to me. So I am more than happy to, as long as I can, I'm more than willing to engage with my colleagues all over the world, and I want a community. I really want a community, a not light but fire community of people who are just like, we're all educators of goodwill, trying to have race conversations, helping each other out. Because there's a lot of ideas. Every time I talk to people, I'm like, oh man, if I was still writing the book, that would definitely be in the book. That's a fantastic idea, and I am so much better. I'm so much better at it in the past month just from hearing from people. So they can definitely reach out to me on Twitter and
let's have a conversation.
Gotta start a fire hashtag, man. Have a Twitter chat.
Not light. Hashtag not light.
And that is it, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I enjoyed it. It's actually kind of a longer interview than we've had recently. I feel like some of our last few episodes have kind of been on the short side, not for any particular purpose, but you know, some conversations lend themselves to a little bit lengthier of a discussion. So I'm glad to know that this one did. I loved having Matthew K on this podcast. He's going to be one of those people I stay in touch with. He is, you know, his name's just now getting out there, you know, with this book and his work that he's doing. I hope he is one of the future rock stars. You know, one of the things that I pride Teach Me Teacher on is even though we're one of the biggest educator podcasts out there, we still, when we talk to people, we get people from all over. So we're still talking to real teachers in real classrooms. We're talking to people that have books published. We're talking to people who don't. We're talking to people who have great Instagram accounts. We're talking to people who have great Twitter accounts. We're talking to people who have none of those things. And they're just fantastic educators that we want to talk to. By the way, I have so many of those coming up of just teachers. They have no book, no nothing. They're just awesome educators that I'm bringing to you guys just to have their insight. You know, I was looking at some of the older episodes, you know, like to scroll through every once in a while and, you know, go down memory lane, I suppose. But, you know, one of my favorite ones is the one I did with Lindsay Stewart, who we used to work at the same school. She was absolutely amazing. But the whole episode is just us talking shop. Like, that's literally the whole episode. I think that would be amazing. I think Teach Me Teacher, you know, we're topical sometimes, and I think we've been topical heavy this season. So I'm going to try to spice things up and have some of those just real teacher conversations to kind of break up what we've been doing. Not to say that I don't love the stuff that we've been doing. I think that diversity is really useful. In any case, I do want to say one more time that this episode was sponsored by Stenhouse. I want to thank them for supporting Teach Me Teacher. If you've been listening to this podcast for any number of years, you know, the last 2 or 3 years that we've been doing the podcast, you know that this is the first time we've ever done sponsorships. It really is the first time that I've ever found a great fit for the podcast. I support tons of stuff that Stenhouse does, and so far they have been super generous in how much they're supporting the podcast, and they're doing some great work, and it's great. They're a great partner to have, so I want to thank them. I need you guys to go into the show notes of this episode and buy Matthew K's book. It is absolutely amazing. I cannot speak highly enough about it. If you don't believe me, go read that chapter one. We talked about it in the podcast. I talked about it. It was one of the things when we were emailing back and forth, Matthew and I, that I mentioned. I was like, I want to talk about chapter one for sure, because it's one of the most powerful opening chapters of any professional development book. So I think that's definitely something that you want to go into. I'm going to link tons of stuff in the show notes. So if you don't go to the show notes normally, if you're just a podcast listener, go back and listen to that. And one last thing, I was just thinking about this as I was talking. You know, the more I do these like closing and opening sessions kind of on my own and just talking directly to you guys, the more I think and the more I kind of want to, and I can't believe I'm actually putting this out there to all of you guys, but I kind of want to do a podcast where it's just, you know, me kind of talking shop about what's happening, you know, teacher ideas and stuff like that. I don't know if it would be connected to Teach Me Teacher, like maybe like a Teach Me Teacher after party, you know, something like that, to where we could, you know, just interact like this. And I could talk directly to you guys, and we could do reader mail and stuff, which we don't really have time for the current format of Teach Me Teacher. So I think that could be really cool. I don't know. Why don't you guys let me know? If you want me to do a side podcast where it would be just me, maybe the occasional other person, but not interview format, but something more along the lines of just discussing, you know, education, discussing things that come up in the news, discussing, you know, what I'm doing in my own classroom, practices, what I see in other, because I'm a coach now, so I get to see stuff all over the place and not just ELA. I don't know. I think that could be really awesome, and we could do, you know, you guys could send in questions, and we could talk about key questions. I don't know. See, just talking about it now, I get excited about it. So, I don't know. I'm not going to do it if no one wants it. So if you're listening to this right now and that sounds like something that you would love to introduce, go to the contact page over there on Teach Me Teacher or DM me on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook if you follow any of those accounts. And let me know. Say, hey, that weird idea, that podcast idea you had at the end of part two with Matthew K., let's do it. Maybe if I get enough of those, I'll put in the effort to add something else to my already massive plate. For everything else, ladies and gentlemen, go to teachmeteacherpodcast.com. We can get every episode of Teach Me Teacher that's ever been made without having to deal with any third-party programs. If you enjoyed this episode or any episode, please go over there, review, like us over there on iTunes and Facebook and Instagram and all those things. Those things helps people find the podcast, specifically the reviews on iTunes. Reviews on iTunes help us keep ranking with the best of the best podcasts that you guys listen to. If you're not, you should go show some love to some of their stuff as well. For everything else, ladies and gentlemen, have a good one.